Okay, that's a wrap. That was great. Leo, you really nailed it. Bear, you were great too.
Excuse me.
What is it, Bear?
I was wondering if I could try it a little differently.
Really? Because that was great. You totally mauled him. And the crew is cold and tired. They want to go back to the motor lodge.
It's just that, as an actor, I'm always trying to get at the thing that's underneath the thing that'll illuminate a moment. I think I see a different way in.
Well, actor? I mean, you're a bear. You're a dangerous and wild animal.
I'm also an artist who is serious about craft. I remember something James Lipton said to me. He said...
We don't have time for that. What is it you want to try?
Okay, after I claw and bite Leo, I run over to the lake and I see my own reflection and I'm like, what have you become? I don't even know you.
Okay, let's try it. I can't guarantee we'll keep it.
That's all I ask. Just let me warm up. Ba-ba-ba-ba, red leather, yellow leather, red leather... Red leather, yellow leather, she stood upon the balcony, mimicking him hiccuping. Roar!
I hate to interrupt, but you don't need to do that.
What do you mean?
Oh, I guess nobody told you, but we're redubbing all your vocal parts. Meryl Streep is going to do all the bear noises.
What? I don't believe this.
It's just that she's so good with accents. She's worked up an amazing bear accent.
I'm a bear! How can Meryl Streep pretending to be a bear be better than a bear? You betrayed me!
Wait, I really like what you're giving me right now. Let's try the scene again, and this time make it sexual.
You mean both bitey and humpy?
Yes. Quiet on the set!
Wait. Leo's not moving. I think he might be dead. Well, we're sorting this out. Listen to the nose. And now, in the uncredited role of Frostbite Pete, Colin McEnroe.
I feel like there ought to be a role called Frostbite Pete in The Revenant. And if so, I would like to play that role. And the good thing is I would have to learn my lines because there wouldn't be any. In fact, we're going to be talking about The Revenant here in the first segment. And we thought about pulling a clip, and I was looking, and I thought, well, there's so little dialogue in The Revenant. It's very hard to do an audio clip for the radio. Let me tell you who's here. First of all, Rand Richards Cooper is here. He is an author, a critic, and now a blogger for Commonweal. Jacques Lamar, playwright and lord of all that he surveys at the Mark Twain House. Tanisha Dugan. Does very special things for TheaterWorks in Hartford. So we're going to talk about The Revenant in the first segment here. In the second segment, we have to sort of try to say something anyway about the Kerouacian endorsement speech given by Sarah Palin on behalf of Donald Trump this week. And then we'll be talking about kind of a failure in the toy department where Star Wars the merchandising of Star Wars seems to have neglected in some sectors to produce interesting toys involving the character Rey, who's the primary female character. This is not an isolated incident. It happens all the time. Anyway, that is all to come. But we have to begin with The Revenant. The Revenant is set in 1823. It features the story of Hugh Glass, who is played by Leo DiCaprio. Hugh Glass signed on with the Rocky Mountain Fur Company for an expedition on the Upper Missouri River. It almost did him in. They were attacked by First Nation people. And he was attacked by a bear. And a lot of the other stuff in the movie is fictionalized. But the fundamental story of Hugh Glass is a real one. And it is a very cold movie to watch. They should have released it in the summer. It would have been really great. But it's directed by Mexican-born filmmaker Alejandro Iñárritu, I think you say, who won Oscars for his work on Birdman, including the Best Picture Award. So many things to say about this. It really is kind of leading the Oscar parade right now, and it's doing extraordinarily well at the box office, considering that it's a movie that, yes, does not have a lot of spoken words and is probably, you know, tilts a little on the arty side, I think it could be argued. So let's talk about, first of all, a general reaction. Is there more going on in this movie than just a standard revenge narrative? And if so, what is the more? Rand, I'll let you kick that one off since you're a movie critic.
One of the mores certainly would require a little bit of amplification of the notion that this is an arty movie. It's also an extraordinarily brutal and violent movie. So if you imagine arty movies to be something that are sort of precious and effete and sensitive and delicate, this is not your movie. My wife, who can't stand violence and brutality on film, if you could design a film to scare her away within 7 minutes of the film's opening, this would be it. It's a film about the forms of violence that men on the frontier are forced to resort to against each other, against animals. It's a sort of farrago of flaying and slicing and gutting out animals so that you can inhabit. You gut out a horse so you can crawl inside the steaming cadaver of the horse to survive a brutal night. So among other things, it is a tenacious chronicle of survival. And you can think of it in terms of the great survival films you've seen. So that's one thing. The other thing I would say is that if it doesn't win the Oscar for Best Cinematography, then that would be a big surprise. This is a beautiful film. It's a visually sublime film. Really, nature is the leading character. And I found it overwhelmingly beautiful. I have a lot of complaints about it, but let me just say right away, it is really a beautiful film to watch.
It's actually shot by Emmanuel Lubezki.
Lubezki, yeah.
Lubezki, who did Yo Mama Tambien, The New World, Children of Men, Tree of Life, Gravity, and is involved in at least two more Terrence Malick films to come. So, yes, it's a very beautiful movie. So I'm gonna have Jacques go last, because I basically lied to Jacques about what the movie was about just to get him even to go see this movie.
He told me Barbara Streisand was in it.
Yeah, I had to tell some lies. Sometimes you just have to do that, and it's important to do. So Tanisha,
Jacques looks like a trapper.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. So Tanisha, did you see stuff lying under? I mean, this is we can say this is some begins with some very bad things happening to Hugh Glass. I guess we won't spoil it any more than necessary, and then asked the question, is he going to be able to do anything about it? And boy, that is totally understating everything that happens. But is there more there for you?
Two and a half hours.
Exactly. I was saying to Jacques earlier, I actually tried to get through it twice. I think it is absolutely a testosterone-filled film. It is painterly. There's no doubt that it's beautiful. It actually resembles the colors in your outfit today in a lot of ways. It's very blue, and
I'm wearing a bearskin today.
He's also wearing a bearskin, and there's a lot of that in this movie as well. But it was just a difficult one for me to get through, and typically I can.
So when you say you tried
anything.
To get through it twice, do you mean you went once and didn't make it all the way through?
Nope.
And then came back?
And then saw it again.
That is like Hugh Glass-like tenacity.
I figured, when you talked about it, I'd already attempted to see it once. And I was like, well, since that was a failed attempt, I should try it again. And it just, maybe it's because there was very little talking, and I'm a talking kind of gal.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think after a while, seeing the beautiful pictures of the landscapes just wasn't enough for me to get it. There's no girls in it. There's no, I sort of was like,
Well, there's no girls
I don't
who,
see
there's
myself.
No girls who
I
are not, who are not being ruthlessly exploited by the white man.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I nodded a few times.
So did you actually walk out the first time? And if so, like, how long did you last?
I did not walk out.
Oh, you just dozed off.
I just dozed off.
You're a mom. Mom thing.
But my partner, who is a dad and equally as, present in my son's life, he loved it, and he loved it the second time, too. I think his experience was similar to Rand's.
Well, I did not love it, but I just haven't detailed my complaints about it.
You saved his complaints. So.
You just wanted to crawl into a warm horse and go to sleep.
Fully clothed. I never quite understood that part. It's freezing outside, and you got.
Who wants to get blood all over their clothes?
Right. So he does. That's not a spoiler to tell you that at one point Leo finds it necessary to crawl into a dead horse.
Han Solo style.
Yeah. Was it Han or Luke?
Well, Han cuts the Tauntaun open. Yeah. Spoiler alert if you haven't seen Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. And Leo first has to gut the horse himself, right. Which we are shown in truly medical detail.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't just go inside the horse. You got to get stuff out of the horse first.
Right. Yes.
Before
all
you go
the
inside
others.
The horse. So, Jacques, it's your turn.
I was trying to decide if I wanted to answer all this in the style of the dialogue of the film.
That's a lot of it.
Thank you.
I mean, that's a lot of it.
I mean, I liked the film well enough. I thought Tom Hardy was the best part of the film, along with the with the cinematography. I mean, I think that Leonardo DiCaprio puts on a good performance, but I wouldn't say it's a best actor performance.
In a crawling role.
Yeah. It had the most crawling I've ever seen in a film.
Because he's always wounded, and also the whole thing takes place in winter. So you sit there feeling this vicarious.
But no one gets frostbite. Did you
notice
that?
Right?
No, but there's always icicles hanging from beards.
Frostbite had not been
invented yet. Frostbite turns out to be a social construction of the 20th century.
Yeah, I was sitting there going, like, why does no one have, like, black digits, you know? My husband really liked it. I thought it was good. It actually reminded me a lot of Gladiator. With him kind of flashing back to his wife and, you know, the atrocities that happens to his child and all this other stuff. And he goes on in this giant kind of revenge journey. So I thought it was basically the same plot as Gladiator, but a lot colder.
You know, I want to pick up on something Tanisha said about talk or the lack of it in the film. There's a sublime, a visually sublime quality to the film that almost requires that there be little talk in order to sort of create and empower that effect of nature's overwhelming sublime. But I felt in this film, as you often do in a film, that there was a different kind of film potentially contained within it that you wished had been let out. And to me, Tom Hardy's excellent performance as the villain is the key to what that other ghost film would be. There's one scene where around the campfire where he's eating and he's telling a story to Tom Hardy, the villainous character, to this younger guy. And it seems to start out to be a story that is maybe going to have a sort of religious payoff point, a virtuous one. And Hardy's eating food. You know, it's the one time in the movie that food is not eaten raw, bloody raw. They actually cooked it. He's telling the story, and then suddenly he gets to this payoff line, and I forget exactly what it is, but it's like devastatingly cynical. And there's more talk in that scene, and there's more revelation of character in that one little exchange than really in the rest of the film. And I kept thinking, all right, if this could be a film about frontiers people and the strategies and the selves that they had to develop and deploy in order to survive and prevail, and that would involve a lot more interaction among them, then that would be a movie I really would love to see. But it would be a much more written film and a much more character-driven film than this one is. So I kept sort of wishing this film was trying to do something a little different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was sort of even more Lonesome Dove. there's a lot of loneliness in this movie.
I don't care how my French Canadian people were represented to on screen.
They were not great.
Or villainous. Ha ha ha.
I want to talk specifically about that. But first of all, let me just say, if you'd like to tweet at us, as for example our confrere Jim Chapdelaine has done, he says it's actually quite peaceful and it fits in with today's theme of rebirth. The horse seems uncomfortable, but unharmed. Anyway, you can tweet at us at WNPR Colin. Greg Hill is waiting to receive your tweets at WNPR Colin. You can even call in 860-275-7266. For me, first of all, I think not only are Jacques' French Canadians unflatteringly portrayed, but in general, the white race is portrayed as an interloper rather than people who really, you know, belong there at the same. On the other hand, there's also not a sentimentalizing of First Nations people, right? The First Nations people are a little bit good, a little bit bad, a little bit obsessed. You know, they have a better chance of being, of having redemptive moments than most of the white characters in the movie. And there's also this sense that that Leo DiCaprio, in many ways, is the kind of person, you know, he's a multiculturalist, right? He's in the movie, the guy, it's a little bit of the Hawkeye thing, but I think, once again, less sentimentalized than the Hawkeye thing. There's this sense that he has lived with First Nation people, that he's married a First Nation, his son is is half First Nation person, and he sees the picture in a much bigger way and a much more inclusive way. These all sound very sort of 2016 words. But, I mean, to me, that's one of the intriguing parts of this. It's, on the one hand, a little bit of a hymn to the First Nation people who are already there, but not without suggesting that they weren't capable of their own ferocity and savagery towards one another and towards whites. I don't know. Anybody want to respond? Did you hate about it so much?
No, the thing that I hated about it. But as I said, first of all, to me, it it started out really big and sort of gradually got smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And the movies that tend to stay with me are the ones that do the opposite thing. Mm. And this film is visually very big. And I remember when I saw the trailer a few months ago, I thought, oh my God, this film, I'm more excited about this movie just based on the trailer than I have been about a lot of other movies. But to me, part of the problem, part of this narrowness was that it ultimately became a very standard revenge story about him chasing down a man that he wants to visit very violent revenge on. He ultimately turns him over to the secular arm of the Native Americans to have it done for him. But
spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
You have no idea how much trouble you just got in.
So I
he was speaking metaphorically, not literally.
Yeah. Yes. So I didn't – I felt like that was a very narrow story surrounded with this visually vaultingly ambitious casing.
Mm-hmm. One thing that has intrigued me, Tanisha, is that the movie's doing very well at the box office. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is not as well as Rideshare 2, but it's doing
– Did you say Ride Along 2?
Ride Along 2 or whatever that is. It's called
Rideshare 2.
Rideshare 2 is
Carpool
the –
Carpool 2.
Yeah, Rideshare – that's the Connecticut DOT has put out Rideshare 2 as well. Ride Along 2.
ZT Fast Track.
ZT Fast Track the movie. All right, so it's doing. I think it was in second place in the box office last weekend. And this, I mean, I don't see this as. I wouldn't have guessed it was a mass audience movie. I mean, it's not a Terrence Malick movie, although it looks a lot like a Terrence Malick movie, partly because that one particular guy shot it, and also because of the kind of hush that's there most of the time. You know, it really is, considering how warlike it is in some ways, and as you said, testosterone infused it is. It's also a very, very quiet movie. Mm. I wouldn't have guessed that audiences would be flocking to go see this, particularly in January.
Part of it is because the buzz around Leo winning the Oscar is mm-hmm. what it is, and I think people want to see what that performance is. More often than not, people aren't very intrigued with what's happening with the Oscars, but he mm-hmm. is one of those blockbuster stars that people love. He's kind of, you know, the Tom Hanks of a generation, and he's in this film that is getting so much praise. You want to see it.
I would recommend. I think the best film that Iñárritu has made is his very first one, Amores Perros, which translates roughly to "Love's a Bitch," which has there's a canine joke built into that, and it's a film was about a dozen years ago. Have you guys seen it?
I have not. I think it's actually in our house.
It's a kind of film that weaves together three plot strands and then has them sort of overlap in a complex architecture of coincidence and fate. And it's in some ways the antithesis of this film because it's very fast. There are lots of characters and lots of talk and lots of flashy action and loud music. But it also has – there's underlying a certain sort of fatalistic, deterministic, you know, mechanism whereby characters are going to be driven through their paces to their inevitable fate. And that makes them very, very similar films, although in every other way they're really very different. But that is – Amores Perros, I think, is a terrific film.
I remember 12 years ago all of my friends loving and being into the cult of that film.
Yeah. But also very violent, too. I mean, that's a hallmark of this guy's films.
Mm. Except for Birdman.
Except for Birdman, yeah.
What were you going to say before? Do you remember?
No, only that I did not realize that if you are shot by an arrow, it inevitably comes out the other side of you.
Yeah. Don't count on that. Yeah.
But in the movie, everyone gets shot with an arrow. It comes out their chest or the other side of their head or what have you. So safety tip for people who are being chased by the Pawnee.
Archers.
Yes.
The other thing that I'll quickly say about this, and then we're going to take a break and get ready for our other two topics here, is that I think it is also destined to become one of those movies whose tribulations in the making of the movie are going to be part of his legend, right?
Like a Fitzcarraldo.
Fitzcarraldo
kind of
has that. Yeah. Fitzcarraldo and Apocalypse Now are the ones I had in my notes. That there's a sense in which this was a hard movie to make. We know that Leo had to go through 5 hours of makeup every day to have all kinds of wounds put on him. That backers pulled out, I think, at one point, and it just they were shooting under adverse conditions. I think usually in British Columbia, and I think also in Argentina, in order to make it look that wild. But it got behind schedule and all
the
this
budget
stuff.
Ballooned. Too, right. Didn't it? By like
$135 million.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's crazy.
It's funny to hear actors reflect on his experience, on Leo's work in this piece, and sort of saying how method it must be because Inarritu had put him through those physical paces. I'm like, oh, well.
I'm just going to add one thing. A film like this, because it's so visually sublime, if there's anything cheesy to it, it's sort of shoved so far below the surface of this sort of vaulting visual ambition. But I would prefer that Liam Neeson film with the wolves. What was that film called?
It was called The Gray.
The Gray. Did you guys see that? I forget what leads Liam Neeson to end up in the woods where it's going to be him or this pack of wolves that survives. I won't give away who survives. But there was
although you'll never look at those little bottles you get on airline liquor carts the same way again.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So I mean, if you're going to go for
that's not a good movie.
It's not a good movie, but I wanted this to be like not so good a movie. And
oh, so you wish it didn't have vaulting visual ambition.
But really, I'd rather go for the slightly cheesy one of Liam Neeson facing off against a wolf at the last scene of the film.
But did you know that you could, like, repair...
I'm going to kill you now. Yeah.
Did you know that you could repair a stoma with gunpowder? I mean, that was something I took away from Revenant.
There's things you can learn. And to Rand's point, Jim Condren tweets, and this same point was made by my significant other who hated The Revenant. Robert Redford's Jeremiah Johnson is a kinder, gentler Revenant. And there's at least one other person in the world, Jim Condren, who feels the same way. By the way, I really love this movie. I would have no trouble giving it Best Picture. None whatsoever. I mean, my favorite movie of the year was Creed, but this is like my second favorite movie of the year. And
I love Creed.
That's like a whole Oscar conversation. There's a lot of that missing.
I mean, to me, I'll just quickly say what I look for this year. Anyway, I mean, I think my standards change from year to year. This year, I'm sort of saying, what can a movie do? You know, what can a movie, what can this form do? You know, and then do it. And that's why, although I think Spotlight's an important movie, a well acted movie, a well thought out movie, I didn't really think that. You know, I mean, that could have been a 3-part TV series just fine, and it would have been the same. Whereas Creed and this movie and, you know, even to a certain extent, The Big Short, which plays around with form a little bit. At least they're doing something, you know?
It's so interesting to hear you say that after you commenting on how the First Nations people are represented in the way they are in this film. And in a lot of ways, it sort of restates the same tropes we've always known. Mm. And so I'm curious to know what you think Revenant is doing or what it does.
Well, that's a fair thing. I mean, I think what it does is, and certainly Leo's character, Hugh Green, is kind of, he is a little bit out of James Fenimore Cooper, right? I mean, it's the same kind of thing. The guy who's gone native a little bit and feels more comfortable with First Nations customs and ideas than he does with those of his own people. So that's a little bit old. But I thought just in terms of the way that, first of all, some of the First Nations people were sympathetically portrayed and sentimentally portrayed. There is one guy who helps Leo. And now that I'm saying all this, I'm thinking you're right that every single one of these things is a well-worn trope. Maybe just the way I saw them fit all together on the screen felt somehow or other new. But yeah, some of them are fairly horrible and I don't know. There's one guy who's just like obsessed with one thing. I guess that's all.
I think we could have combined this with A Walk in the Woods, and it was like Nick Nolte and Robert Redford trying to exact revenge on one another. I would have liked it better.
All right, and Bucket List too. All right, we have to take a break here. We'll come back with more, the proverbial more. DiCaprio. All right, we are indeed back. So last night, well, it's been sort of an interesting week for going out and talking about politics. Last night I was with Steve Kornacki from MSNBC, and we were talking about the fact that this really is a kind of a campaign that just keeps on giving, provided you have an appetite for kitsch and things like that. So that, I mean, in this week alone, first of all, I mean, I keep imagining Hillary Clinton kind of pacing back and forth thinking, well, what else could possibly go wrong? You know, like there's already a whole movie out about Benghazi and stuff like that. And then we find out that there was a documentary film crew embedded with the Wieners at the time of the whole Carlos Danger incident. And it has all kinds of footage of Huma Abedin, her primary aide, trying to cope with her husband's sexting. I didn't put that on the list of things to talk about today, but instead, the other thing that happened this week, and it happened on Tuesday night when we were down doing the Wheelhouse Uncensored. We were sort of getting ready to do this thing, and Tucker Ives kept saying, you know, I think Palin's endorsing Trump right now. And so we didn't really get to see it happen live, but it's, of course, this very amazing thing. And we're going to steal this kind of a supercut of the Palin speech from Stephen Colbert. So if you hear people laughing in the background, that's the Colbert audience. And these are just kind of clips from this amazing speech, all just kind of stitched together.
Neck, and then they tell us, just chill, okay, just relax. They've been wearing this political correctness, kind of like a suicide vest. We kowtow, and we apologize, and then we bend over and say, thank you, enemy. You ready for a commander-in-chief who will let our warriors do their job and go kick ISIS ass? And then, funny, haha, not funny, but now what they're doing is wailing, well, Trump and his trumpeters, well, they're not conservative enough. He doesn't get his power, his high, off of opium, other people's money. He builds big things, things that touch the sky. Right-winging, bitter, clinging, proud clingers of our guns, our God, and our religions, and our Constitution. No more pussyfooting around. Can I get a hallelujah?
All right.
Wait,
so what was that? That was kind of a super. That was
a mashup.
Stephen Colbert doing kind of a supercut of a mashup of various high points, I guess.
But all of those phrases were uttered by her.
Oh yes,
that was actually all
during that. Yes, during an endorsement.
Yeah,
and that's not even like the second crazy speech that she gives during the week too, which is also nutsy.
And well, and also we do her a disservice in just playing the audio version of it, because the gestures, the faces and grimaces that are pulled, and of course the sweater itself, the sweater which is like visible from the space shuttle.
That was an amazing top.
Yeah,
I have to.
How would you
that.
Describe the top?
She's lost.
It was
Cole
like
Wallace.
It was almost like silver bugle beads or something. It was. I'd wear it.
Yeah, the top was. Yeah, well, anyway.
It was distracting,
yeah.
Though.
So, but Tanisha, there's sort of a fine line between stupid and brilliant, you know? They're like, there's all these Whitman-esque touches and these Allen Ginsberg kinds of. I'm thinking, you know, if you tried to write something like this to get that effect as opposed to just sort of stumbling through it the way she does, it'd be really hard to do.
Well, clearly rhyming in hip-hop is not her mm-hmm. particular brand. And I do find it fascinating that so much of that speech was in rhyming couplets. I thought, well, this is very odd. Why here now are we talking in this way? But she is stupid.
Right.
I don't know if brilliant is...
She's straight out of Wasilla.
She's straight out of Wasilla. No doubt.
And there are so many ways in which to kind of go at this. And by the way, we welcome your tweets at WNPR Colin, including, I mean, you do sort of wonder, it's a very, very crazy speech, Jacques. And you sort of wonder whom it would reach, like who its audience would be. And I mean, all it needs to do is influence like 400 votes here and 500 votes there in places like Iowa. And it'll be a very useful speech to Donald Trump. Although I don't know if I was the only one, but I kept watching Trump's face, you know, and he goes through this whole series of facial expressions, and you wonder how much of the comedy he's getting. Yeah, and actually, Rand is doing a few of them.
I was sitting there watching Trump. After a bit, thinking like, what could possibly be going through his mind?
Right, exactly.
Like, is this the worst thing that could happen to me, or is this amazing?
Right. It's,
and the thing is, I mean, you know, it's hard to assess how smart he is, but you know, he's sitting there, probably thought, oh, this is going to be amazing for my campaign, which is already doing, you know, mind-bogglingly well. And then she just lets loose for 20 minutes, and it's just this fright show. And but you know, my question is, I guess, how many of the people who are supporters of hers wouldn't already be supporting him? Mm-hmm. They seem like they're cut from the same cloth. So we had at the Mark Twain House last night, David Silverman, who's the president of American Atheists, And he's, you know, he was making a point. He's like, you know, the evangelicals have been very quiet during this campaign. Like, they haven't really come out, you know, for, you know, behind candidates that you'd think they gravitate towards, like a Ted Cruz or a Rick Santorum, you know, people who are very, you know, proud about their faith. And there's a lot of support in the community for Trump who, you know, can't even name a Bible verse. So David Silverman was, you know, saying that this was the kind of thing, you know, Sarah Palin's appearance is the kind of thing that could help shore up support among the evangelical community for Trump.
Rand?
Well, it's such a multifaceted phenomenon that it's hard to know what to address. But I guess I'd say this. Here's one context to think about it in, and it's the context of Republican populism, or what is now passing for some kind of brand of populist energy that is funneled into the traditional machine of Republican politics. And that's a weird – that's not a good fit. But what's happening in the Republican Party, as David Frum in that great Atlantic article I think that you've discussed talked about, and what's tearing the Republican Party apart is that as an essentially populist energy is trying to be accommodated within the Republican Party. Now, how is that supposed to happen? Now, because that has traditionally not been able to happen by being addressed toward the masters of Wall Street and finance, for instance, or corporate America, it has to find some other way to go. Going back to Nixon, it is directed toward liberal elites. And it is also directed stylistically toward the way that liberal elites sound, think, talk, and the way that they pronounce judgment. So there's a way in which Trump and now Palin are perfectly inoculated against any kind of criticism that they're stupid or that they sound stupid. Because right. Every time liberal elites and intellectuals make those criticisms, they are in fact only reaffirming the sort of political structure in which these people have arisen. And thus the seemingly paradoxical dynamic of their unsinkability, at least through any sort of gaffes that anyone in a forum like this might ever call attention to. It makes them stronger. And you know, so in that sense, it, among others, it's not surprising that Palin was – she's a perfect fit because she brings that that
but
paradoxical
but
strength.
Does she still have sort of, the, sorry.
No, I was, she's also sort of moved away from pointing the finger solely at liberal elites. I mean, in this endorsement speech, she was really pointing
both
to
sides
any
of the aisle.
Intellectual who will right. come at – what she's saying, what Trump believes in,
right.
and really setting up this us against them. If you, you know, think that my daughter, who is, you know, a abstinence-based thought leader, is wrong, you are one of them. You don't support real America, the hardworking, you know, folks who have built that big building that Trump has built his success on. You, too, can be a part of it. She is really distancing herself from any kind of intellectual
and that yeah. battle is happening right now. The we may Absolutely. Talk about this on Monday. The National Review has basically now dedicated itself to trying to pull down Trump.
Right.
Right.
The National Review, an unlikely source of criticism.
You sent along
exactly.
and right. What was the opening line of that column? That great piece you sent around.
Oh. The moth. It's like a moth to a
yeah, like a moth to a flame.
Yeah.
Right. Any flame that's left untended will inevitably draw curious moths.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Trump and Palin. It was a brilliant piece of writing.
Well, Jacques, there's another part of this, and I go to you as something of an expert in the genre, another part of Palin, which is that – and this seems to be inevitable – that any time she's making this kind of public theater happen in this scripted and planned way, or at least quasi-scripted and planned way, there's this reality show happening in the background. I mean, this seems to happen every single time. So almost coterminous with this speech that she's giving for Donald Trump is kind of a 24-hour story arc that started a little bit the day before involving her son, Track, and a gun and punching a woman in the head and kicking her in the knee and arrests. And it almost seems as though this family is built for the age that we live in, where you have to be Kardashians. You have to have Absolutely. Multiple plot lines.
But, you know, the Kardashians aren't even a freak show on a level that these
But
that
according
the
to Cosmo,
are.
They are our first yeah. family.
No, but I mean, I'm sorry. But the Palins, I mean, it's just like You know, and then for her to go on stage and blame her son's behavior on PTSD caused by Barack Obama is like such an incredible logic leap that it defies, you know, defies everything, you know, good taste, logic. And vets are like coming back at her about this. One of the things I wonder is how much support does she really have at this point? Or is it just that the cameras will show up for the freak show? She didn't tip the scales in McCain's favor. In fact, she probably went, you know, it probably went the opposite direction. She's lost her contract with Fox. She doesn't have a reality show anymore. So, you know.
Well, I think the answer will be, is she anywhere to be seen during the general election, no matter who the nominee is? I mean, I think right now they're playing small ball, and some of these primary contests are really won by small handfuls of votes. So if she supercharges, you know, once again, 400, 500 people, that really could be quite meaningful with a multi-candidate field and then small states to play in. With two candidates in the entire nation, it gets very different.
Yeah. I also think you can't underestimate the fact that her family is a disaster, and that feels familiar to so many people.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean?
Tanisha, I was thinking, how am I going to make this point? You made it. What are the problems that a family like the Obama family has? Well, what college is my daughter going to get accepted? Which Ivy League college will my daughter get accepted into? There's a familiar set of problems that the professional class, the upper middle class has. And then there's the Palins and the sector of the population that they're appealing to. Hey, it's like there's a lot of really ragged stuff that goes on in our families. And you know what? She's one of us.
But the thing is, she's always staking out the moral high ground. And then, you know, her family's undercutting her at the same time.
I agree, absolutely. But that hypocrisy is so American. It's just such an, you know, like that you strive to be.
Baby having, I'm trying to think of like what's a good, what was that rhyme that she had going there? I came up with an earlier version pertaining to Barbara Streisand.
The right wing in that one?
Yeah, the right wing.
Oh, trail, baby, trail. Yeah.
The other thing I would say about Palin and Trump and the way that they talk, I mean, I think most of us, what you want in a candidate is really two things. One, a person who agrees with and represents my values. And two, a person who is as capable as possible and a person who's smarter than I am. I mean, I don't want someone like me to be president. I want someone who's like five times smarter than I am. But I think at this point
– not possible.
Right. The particular –
that person
type,
doesn't walk the earth.
The particular toe – oh, Jacques, you're – I don't know if I can continue. The person who's voting for Palin and Trump, I think, is sufficiently disenchanted to think, what has any politician who sounds really smart gotten for me, done for me? And I no longer trust that. That seems technocratic, and under the face of a sort of technocratic glibness, all sorts of exploitations of me and people like me are happening. So I'm done with that.
All right. We're going to have to quickly jump topics if we want to get this in here. We don't have a whole lot of time to talk about this. And we've played this song before. We've talked about this in the past. But with the new Star Wars movie out, there are toys. There are things to be marketed. And many of those things, many of the things made by the Hasbro company in particular, do not seem to represent very well Rey, the character played by Daisy Ripley, and who's really one of the protagonists of this. And it's started a hashtag, hashtag Where's Rey, on Twitter. It's started a lot of different debates. We think of our own Julia Pastel played a part in a conversation that was had up at Lego in which she sort of pointed that out. And the Lego executives sort of seemed to be thinking, oh, we better do a pretty good job of making sure Rey is prominently featured in our Star Wars sets. But this had happened before with Princess Leia, who's also underrepresented in Star Wars toys, and the Black Widow in the Avengers series, where infamously they made the Black Widow's motorcycle, but not the Black Widow, mistakenly thinking the prepubescent boys don't want to play with Scarlett Johansson. I don't really get that. But anyway.
Oh, man, you've just opened up a whole other dimension.
True. But, well, actually, Rand, I'll let you start because you are the father of a daughter. So does this bother you?
It interests me. I guess it bothers me. One thing that if you monitor your child's development through the early years closely, you know, you're interested in paying attention to the whole sort of nature versus nurture thing. And you see the ways in which, even if you're trying not to, other actors in the culture push your child in a certain direction and not in another direction. At age 9, which my daughter is, it's the moment where, like, now the girls are really playing with girls and the boys are playing with boys. And she's always been interested in playing boys and with boys, and she's a tomboy. And you know, one doesn't like to see that sort of rectified or curbed or redirected. Now, the people who cross-market and create products from movies, especially movies that are massively popular in our culture, are creating for young – they're like wielding the building blocks in part that create the way our kids experience themselves and each other in the world. And what they'll tell you, the marketers, is like, there's no market for that. Well, a lot of times they think they're just being descriptive of a reality that actually exists, but they're actually being prescriptive in a way. And by putting this out there and not that, they are limiting the options that little kids who are still learning how the world works are going to have in the way that world is put together. So to me, I was skeptical of this story at first, but I think it's worth paying attention to from that particular point of view of a child's development.
Well, it's also interesting there are all these constituencies about this now, too. I mean, one of the articles that we read quoted this guy John Marcotte, who's got an activist group, and then there's another group called the Legions of Leia who are concerned about – what are you laughing at over there?
We need to get a hobby.
It is amazing that these groups –
that
these
is
groups
a hobby.
No, like a useful one. It's funny. I talked to a coworker of mine who was actually involved in some of the product design and launch for Phantom Menace. Mm-hmm. And he said they had put together a big push for Queen Amidala stuff for girls, and that it turned out to be a big dog in mm-hmm. terms of a seller. And so, you know, if you look at that, then you say the next thing that comes along, you know, whether it's reissue of old Star Wars figures or what have you, are these action figures actually going to be purchased if they're on the market, or are they going to end up, you know, sitting there
on the clearance rack?
On the clearance rack.
So, Tanisha, you get the last word on this. Is that it? We get the toys we deserve.
We get the toys that we want and that we actually buy. I think that's the moral of the story. I worked for a toy company for a long time, and they are data-driven folks. And mm-hmm. If it's there, if the market is actually truly there or shown some interest before, they're not taking risks on that dollar. So.
Right. They would sell you a Gloria Steinem action figure if Gloria Steinem action figures sold.
Exactly.
All right. We have to stop there, so we'll have time for some recommendations when we come back after this.
Smiling girls and rosy boys, come and buy my little toys. Monkeys made of gingerbread and sugar horses painted red.
Heads are spinning, all you lamestream public radio listeners with your Steve Inskeep banana keepers and your Renee Montaigne Tupperware Bible haters, because today's credits are being broadcast in Palinese. Those producers and seducers and produce managers and nurse Betsy's and bionic wolves aren't wearing their suicide vests just because the weak-kneed cream puff host isn't in it to win it. And now how about that Greg Hill making babies and writing poems and tweeting? Hey, get a real job, not bend over and say thank you, information technology. You interns, you're not real doctors, so don't try a pelvic on me, Stephanie Reef and Ross Levin. And Bill Curry, he's going rogue right and left, and the main thing is he doesn't know what the main thing is, but the main thing is some kind of website on WNPR.org/Colin. On Monday, my guess is some slurping off the gravy train with a hamburger helper. You betcha. And now, back to Colin.
All right. That was excellent. It's time to do some recommendations. And so, Rand, why don't you go first? Okay. Because you've got
I'm a dinner and a movie guy, so let's do that. For dinner, there's a newish restaurant in Granby called The Barn. The owner, James Chen, owns three Asian-themed restaurants in Granby and Simsbury. This is a new place. It's in a converted carriage house He has the chef, Dan Fortin, who is the chef at Infinity in Norfolk and in Hartford. Sort of steak, seafood, and a few other things, but it's a lovely place. Food is terrific. The Barn in Granby. If you're trying to play catch up with the Oscar films, that is not ketchup and mustard, but to catch up, I would recommend seeing Room. I would warn away people who do not like intense films about trauma and recovery, but if your interest is in how people, including children, get past traumatic events in their lives and live again, it's a terrific film to see. Do not read any review of it before you see it, because it's a very interesting and unusual plot that does not announce itself originally, but all reviews necessarily spoil the plot. So don't read a review. Just take my review of it, and it's worth seeing. Room.
And just to put a little exclamation and point on this, you might consider, because your only option right now is going to Bowtie on New Park Avenue and seeing it with their crummy projection equipment, unless you live somewhere else other than the greater Hartford area. If you live in New Haven, maybe it's different. James Hanley will have it at Cine Studio. At least it's on the calendar right now for the end of the month, the last weekend in January. And you can see it on good projection equipment, unless they steal it from him, which happens sometimes. Tanisha, what have you got?
Tinmo Astro, the projector series at Real Artways, runs next week, June 28th, 29th, and 31st. Head to Real Artways' website.
All right. What is that? What is the thing?
Tinmo Astro. It's an performance art installation at Real Artways.
All right. And Jacques, what have you got for us?
I want to endorse supporting the Hartford Symphony Orchestra and their upcoming concerts. After everything that they've been through, we need to remind ourselves why it's important to have the Hartford Symphony Orchestra here. And the best thing to do is to go hear them perform and be enchanted by them. So I certainly recommend wholeheartedly that you go check out the Hartford Symphony.
Yeah, it's given the amount of interest that has been shown in the drama of their labor negotiations, you'd think that their audience would be really robust. I mean, every story we ever put on our website winds up, you know, leading the website in hits, and there's been an infinite number of letters to the editor, to the Current. You'd think that they would have the audience that would go with that. So I hope you're right, and I second that emotion as well.
The audible gasp you hear when people hear the phrase 36% pay cut should immediately lead to a sense of obligation at going to support the people who just took that massive cut.
Yeah, it's a great recommendation. Okay, I'm going to recommend three non-new movies, and I'll tell you why. So if you go to see Room and you love the performance by Brie Larson, who's been nominated for all kinds of things, and I think she won a Golden Globe already for Best Actress, see Short Term 11. It's a small movie, an independent movie. I think it came out maybe 2 years ago. And it's about young people working in a short-term mental health unit. And that doesn't sound very, very inspiring or very – but it's actually very funny in certain ways and very touching in other ways. I would also recommend – Rand just made me think of this when he was talking about sort of that conservative or working-class notion that smart people never do anything for you. Go see the movie Smart People. And don't go see it. You have to like maybe order it on Amazon or something. Smart People with Dennis Quaid and Sarah Jessica Parker and Thomas Hayden Church. And it sort of is about sort of smart people, the kind of smart people who don't connect very well emotionally with the people around them. And then lastly, right now we're developing here at Connecticut Public Broadcasting a TV series called Cobblestone Corridor, which is going to be kind of a noir TV series set in a prep school, which makes me think of one of my favorite obscure movies, Brick, with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Maybe the best Joseph Gordon-Levitt performance ever.
That's a terrific movie.
Isn't it a good movie? It is such a good movie. And everybody else in it stayed pretty obscure except for Lucas Haas, who is actually in The Revenant, so there's a tie-in. Lucas Haas is a drug kingpin, except the whole thing is a noir movie that is set in a high school, in a sort of a California high school. And they never stop being high school students, and they never stop being kind of committed to the idea that they're in a noir movie. So all of those things. And then lastly, I would like to recommend or endorse the Spotlight Theaters down in Front Street. It's been great going down to Front Street lately for movies. And those are really beautifully run movie theaters with really good equipment, really terrific sound and all that kind of stuff. And then you can walk out the door and you can eat, you know. You can go to Bears. You can do all kinds of stuff. You can go to Bears to get barbecue after you've seen the bear in The Revenant, or you can go to one of the restaurants that's sprinkled around there. And I was down there over the weekend on Sunday night, and Front Street was hopping, and that was a good thing to see. So thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll be back on Monday. Yeah.
Sarah Palin, you've endorsed Donald Trump.
I bet Charles Darwin never understood this.
Right, but I'm wondering why, because Trump represents...
severe moral decay.
So then what are you hoping to get out of this?
To accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States.
Really? After what happened last time? I mean, that...
makes the Spanish Inquisition seem like Disneyland.
Thank you for your time, Governor Palin.